Thank you for joining me today on CMDA Matters, a weekly podcast of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations, where we are all about changing hearts in healthcare. I'm Dr. Mike Chupp, your host and the chief executive of CMDA. Well, this week, our spotlight will be on campus ministry, as my guest is one of the nation's leading attorneys on religious freedom, especially freedom for student religious groups who are seeking recognition at public universities in the United States. Right now, at CMDA, we have 325 student groups meeting on healthcare campuses all across the country. Over the last few years, we have seen increasing pushback against the first freedoms of free speech and free exercise of religion, and that includes challenges for our CMDA students as they train in healthcare. You know, in my first month at CMDA in the fall of 2016, I was introduced to my guest today because she was assisting one of our CMDA campus groups that was in crisis. And that group were Christian Physician Assistant students who had come under fire because of our student leadership requirements dealing with marriage and sexual conduct. My guest today, Kim Colby, was very instrumental in helping that particular PA student group respectfully but courageously hold to our CMDA positions on marriage and on sexual behavior. And eventually, they were actually reinstated by that university. Kim is going to share with you today some good news on more support for the First Amendment rights on college campuses and for our graduate groups. You're also going to hear the voice of Dr. Jeff Barros, who has been leading the charge of our national ministry in the areas of bioethics and public policy. I welcome you to listen in on our recent conversation with a wonderful, longtime friend of CMDA, Kim Colby of the Christian Legal Society. Well, it is indeed my delight to invite to the program today Kim Colby, who has been working for the Christian Legal Society Center for Law and Religious Freedom. And she has been on this journey for a long time. She graduated from Harvard Law School in 1981 and has been involved in all kinds of litigation cases that have even gone up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And just a little bit about Christian Legal Society, they have been partners with CMDA for a long time. And Kim, I had a chance to talk to our wonderful friend and mentor for both Dr. Barros, who's with me in the studio today, Dr. Gene Rudd. And Gene tells me that we date back to 1961 working together when the Christian Legal Society shared office space with the Christian Medical Society in Oak Park, Chicago. You probably don't remember that, I'm guessing.
I think I do, actually. It's kind of sad to remember back that far, but they were good days. And I think at one point, probably before I was on board, we also shared an executive director. That was a very long time ago.
Wow, that's amazing. Do you remember who that was?
Lynn Buzzard, for a while, I think, was the executive director for both CMDA and CLS.
We do share a lot of things in common. Tell us a little bit more, expand our listeners' understanding today about the Christian Legal Society.
Right. Well, I think we do have a lot in common. We do have local chapters for our attorney members, and our student chapters at law schools are very much like what you do. And I think it's for a similar reason, which is that both organizations, both CLS and CMDA, minister to people who are in very stressful professions. And so both the law school and medical school experience are very stressful. And then once you're out in practice, you're facing a lot of questions that you really want your faith to inform you. And it's very important to have encouragement from others who are in your profession who really understand what you're going through more than anyone else.
Well, the last couple of years have been good years, I think, in terms of looking at campus access for Christian students, wherever they might be, whether they're undergrad or grad school. And My understanding is that last year there was an executive order that came out of the White House that really sort of launched activities by the Department of Education. Could you summarize for us what's happened both last year and this that has been so encouraging to you and CLS?
Last year there was an executive order about free speech on campus and protecting free inquiry on campus. And as a part of that, the Department of Education adopted several new rules, and one of them specifically protects religious student groups' right to meet on campus.
Earlier this year, Kim, you reached out to Jonathan, our director for government relations and policy, and said, hey, there's an opportunity here to speak into a new rule coming out of the Department of Education, which will protect our students and our student leaders in public universities. And I believe there were quite a number of responses, were there not, for the new rule that was issued back in January?
Right. There were a total of 17,000 comments submitted to the Department of Education about the proposed rule. And it covered there were several rules bunched together. So the 17,000 comments were addressing several different rules, but they included our campus access rule. So that's quite a bit of response, and it was so important that the Department of Education hear from especially the students or former students who had faced problems of discrimination on campus because of the religious speech, beliefs, and leadership standards of their groups.
Well, Kim, I know that this new rule coming out of the Department of Education is really good news for all of us as faith-based organizations, granting several different protections and allowing us to be treated the same as any other organization on a campus. And I wanted to ask you, since this ruling came in part out of an executive order that was issued last year, does that mean that it's going to be easier for a new administration down the road to reverse this new rule and take it back to perhaps where it was before?
It does mean that. We would like to see a statute, something that Congress passes to protect religious student groups. And Jonathan Embody's been tremendous in helping us, you know, just educate people about the need for legislation to protect religious student groups. But in the meantime, we did obtain this final rule from the Department of Education, and it will do a great job for students if it's left to do that job. But as you know, each administration comes in, and an administration can decide whether it's going to enforce a rule or not enforce it, and also whether it's going to even try to get rid of the rule. That is certainly a possibility if a different administration were to come in to office.
My understanding is that it gets tricky when we're dealing with public schools versus private schools, and then understanding the difference between what constitutes a religious or private school and what constitutes a public school, over which this new rule will definitely have bearing.
That's a really great point, because this rule does apply only to public colleges and universities. And that's because that's where the First Amendment applies. Private colleges have a right to not follow what the First Amendment requires, although they do have to follow, if their handbook promises that they will respect free speech and religious freedom, then they do have to do that. So this final rule tells public colleges that they cannot discriminate against religious student groups because of this group's speech, beliefs, policies, practices, and membership or leadership standards. Because we've run into kind of the strangest problem in the past, it's been almost two decades now, where, and CMDA's run into this problem, CLS has, other undergraduate religious campus ministries have as well. We've always required that our leaders agree with our statement of faith, because we want leaders who are Christians and have our understanding of what the Bible teaches about a variety of issues. Public university administrators and some private have over the past 20 years said to us sometimes that that is discriminating on the basis of religion and therefore violates their non-discrimination policy. Well, we like non-discrimination policies generally because there's no reason why the ski club or the chess club or whatever group should discriminate on the basis of religion. But what we have trouble getting the administrators to understand is it's not really discrimination when the religious groups say our leaders have to agree with our religious beliefs. In the broader world, that right is protected. Religious employers can hire only people who agree with their faith. But on campus, for some reason, the university administrators have been using, and I think it's misusing, non-discrimination policies to actually threaten religious groups with exclusion from campus if they try to live according to their religious beliefs.
Kim, those groups that have been maybe working against these campus religious freedom rules or laws, I'm guessing that some of them may say, wait a second, this is First Amendment. There are already statutes and laws in place that protect these students. Would you agree or disagree with that statement? And if you disagree, explain how existing statutes or laws that were there before the executive order aren't protecting students today.
So I would agree that the First Amendment should protect these groups and their right to choose their leaders. But we've just run into a lot of problems in getting that First Amendment right implemented in a strong way. And so we needed something that just explicitly made clear to the university administrators what they should and shouldn't be doing. And that's why this regulation was so necessary, is it's very explicit. It addresses a specific problem. It addresses it narrowly. It doesn't force universities to have any particular policy. We just say whatever policy you have, you can't use it to exclude religious student groups. And we're hoping that that clarity will help us to avoid problems. Our groups, and this is true for CMDA and CLS groups and all the other religious groups, we're on campus to try to be a positive influence. We want to be there for our schools, for the administration, and for other students. And so we don't want to spend a year arguing about whether or not we get to require our leaders to agree with our religious beliefs. We just want to be on campus doing good things. And so this rule, by being very clear, we're hoping will solve a lot of problems.
Well, Kim, knowing that this rule, as great as it is right now, may not be permanent, I wanted to ask, are there proactive measures that a campus group or a national organization like CLS or CMDA can take that will protect their status as an on-campus student organization?
Yes. So right now, we're waiting to see what happens in the coming months, but we will be still trying to get Congress to pass a federal law. And right now, the bill that has been introduced that would protect our groups, the number is S for Senate, 1168, and Senator Blunt, along with Senators Lankford and Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, introduced this over a year ago. It has 31 co-sponsors. And so, you know, it's probably too late this Congress to get anything done, but we're hoping in the new Congress that we'll be able to get legislation that will, you know, really nail down this right. The rule is great. And I just can't thank the CMDA people enough for their comments. It was just amazingly helpful. But we still would like to see something written in statute because it's very hard to undo a statute.
Well, we've seen at CMDA that some rules that have come out of Health and Human Services have been attacked immediately by groups. Any anticipation that this rule could have the same thing happen during this 60-day waiting period, that actually someone might take them to court?
I have not seen any threats of that so far, but we're, you know, watching. But what we really hope is this is really just fairness. We're not asking for special favors or anything. We're just asking basically to be let alone to run our groups internally the way that we think they should be run. And so I think the biggest problem we had, honestly, in getting this rule adopted and then also when we meet about the legislation is just making people understand that this problem is actually happening. It sounds so kind of unlikely to say that religious groups on campus are threatened with being excluded because they require their leaders to be religious, but that is what's happened. So hopefully the whole common sense of it, that religious groups should be able to choose their leaders according to their religious beliefs, hopefully that will dissuade the people who have been going after so many of the other rules from taking this one to court.
Kim, I wanted to ask you, what should campus group leaders do now with the rule in place, and maybe down the road, even if the rule's gone, if they encounter discrimination or inappropriate requirements by school officials wherever they are?
The first thing to do is just to make sure that the paperwork that they're submitting to their campus is in order. It's what you at CMDA National want them to be submitting. CLS, we have a model constitution. And then as soon, and we stress this with the CLS students, as soon as they have any inkling that they might have a problem with being recognized, and often this will happen at campuses where they've been a recognized group for years, but then there'll be a new administrator or a student government will raise a problem. As soon as there's any inkling of a problem, they should communicate with the national organization just to give them a heads up and to find out how to proceed. Because at CLS, there are times where we have repeat offenders. We say, oh yeah, it's that campus. And we sort of know who to go to on that campus to talk to de-escalate the problem. And other times we have to say, no, we're not going to change our leadership requirements. We may need to send a letter, you know, to the administrators to explain why religious groups get to have religious leadership requirements. So I think the most important thing they can do is just get in touch with you as soon as possible and work with you going forward. And then the other thing I just stress is just to have good relationships with the other organizations on campus, either those of other faiths or even, you know, some of the groups that might be very contrary to what the mission of your particular group, because those good relationships are very important when a problem arises.
What is there about these Iowa cases, either InterVarsity or the Christian Business Association? You know, we've been following with interest with you how these cases have gone, and there's been an appeal, I believe, that was made. Round one, I think, went in our favor, the Christian organization's favor, but it's been appealed. Talk to us a little bit about these cases and what's unique about a Midwest state like Iowa and these universities and why they're picking on these Christian groups.
The University of Iowa is not always like the rest of Iowa. I actually like talking about this situation because it just illustrates the problem beautifully. So basically, the University of Iowa, about 2 years ago, well, 3 years ago, there was a problem with a small group there, a small Christian group where, again, like you were saying, they welcomed anyone to attend their meetings and to participate. But someone applied to be one of their leaders, and he did not agree with what the Bible, in the view of this group, teaches about marriage. And so they said, if you don't agree with that and you won't conform your conduct to our understanding of the biblical rules for sexual conduct, then you can't be a leader. You can continue to participate. And so instead, that student filed a complaint with the university that he was being discriminated against. And the university said, okay, small Christian group, you're no longer a recognized student organization. So that little group filed a lawsuit with the help of Beckett Fund, another religious liberty organization. And then the rest of the groups on campus started getting a little nervous because the university, in order to litigate against this small group, they started realizing, the university did, oh, this small group's not the only one that has religious beliefs that we don't like. That's really what's happening here. The university administrators don't like the religious beliefs of some of these groups. And so eventually, the university told InterVarsity and 30 other groups, including the CLS group, that they would be derecognized. They would no longer be recognized student groups because they required their leaders to agree with their religious beliefs. And those groups were not only evangelical Christian groups or even Catholic groups, but they were Jewish groups, Sikh groups, Muslim groups. The LDS Church had a problem as well. And all of this was just because those groups required their leaders to agree with what our understanding of what the Bible teaches about marriage and sexual conduct.
How much of the time with these cases is it really purposeful? And somebody comes in and learns of these faith-based groups and they don't like their approach, and so they purposefully kind of infiltrate them, attempt to join the leadership, and then make it clear that they have a different stance on whatever it is. In the case of Iowa, it was marriage, so that they can be refused, and then they can take that then and file a suit. Do you have a sense that this happens more commonly on a purposeful basis, or is it more likely just a series of coincidence?
Sometimes it's purposeful. Sometimes it is the student government decides to take a stand and go after the religious groups. Sometimes it's a new administrator in the student life office, and sometimes it can be the at Vanderbilt a few years back. It seemed to be at the very highest levels of the administration. So it can be at all levels. But also what happens is often we see a problem where, like at Indiana University, no one had complained about any religious group. There'd been no problem. But the university decides to change its policy, and suddenly groups that have been there for 50 years are told you can no longer have your statement of faith requirement. And then we pushed back on that, and Indiana University, after a year, backed down. But that's often how we see it arise, is they'll just, a university will just suddenly adopt a new policy, and it's unfortunately one that we can't agree to.
From CMDA, we are so grateful for the Christian Legal Society and the partnership, the collaboration we've had over all of these years, Kim, and just want to wish you success together with all the rest of the leaders in your organization, and look forward to seeing how this plays out, this new rule, and thank you, Kim.
And Kim, thank you for all your work for all of us as Christians in terms of protecting our freedoms and making sure that we can have meetings not only in campuses but in various other places. We certainly wouldn't have them without attorneys, lawyers like you that are fighting for our faith. So thank you so much for your work.
Well, we can't do it without people, everyone kind of standing behind us and filing the comments and making their views known. So thank you so much.
I trust that you are encouraged by this conversation with Kim Colby from the Christian Legal Society. But I do want to emphasize something she pointed out during the interview, that one of the biggest challenges that the Christian Legal Society faces is a general lack of understanding or disbelief among people like you and me that somehow freedom for religious groups on public universities is indeed at risk. She emphasized that definitive legislation is needed by Congress to protect Christian groups like our CMDA chapters all across the country from activist administrations. You heard us talk about Iowa University, and actually my alma mater, Indiana University School of Medicine, in the heart of the Midwest. It was not California, not New York. In that situation, there were no complaints against the student group by other students or even faculty. It was simply a unilateral move by an administration that was taking up a progressive social cause involving our leadership standards for student leaders dealing with marriage and sexuality. CLS got involved with us to help resolve that conflict there in Indianapolis between that administration and our student group, and we were so pleased with the result of their help. I was involved in that student group in Indiana in the mid-1980s, and for me it was a lifeline. I don't know what our student group would have done if our administration back then had come after us and made it difficult for us to meet because of what we believed. At CMDA, we are most thankful for our advocacy partners like CLS and the Beckett Fund and Alliance Defending Freedom for their partnership and enduring support. You should know that as often as the Supreme Court of the United States in its past has stood on the side of religious freedom, supporting our First Amendment rights. A strong standing legal precedent from the Supreme Court is actually from 2010 and stands today. And it's a case actually involving Christian Legal Society versus Martinez. One legal scholar from Regent Law School writes about that 5-4 decision, quote, "Alas, the Christian Legal Society decision is a disaster. The case holds by a vote of 5-4 that Christian student groups at public universities do not have the First Amendment right to maintain a distinctive Christian identity or to have a statement of faith to which their members or even just their leaders can be expected by others in the group to subscribe." The author goes on to say, simply stated, student religious groups on state university campuses do not possess First Amendment rights to freedom of association for expressive purposes. That holding is a fundamental negation of the right of Christian campus groups to freedom of speech, to freedom of association, and to the collective free exercise of religion, a First Amendment disaster trifecta, end quote. Kim Colby told me after our interview that the CLS versus Martinez decision is one of the flimsiest high court decisions ever made, and that it stands on the legal chopping block, so to speak, to be overturned. I really want to thank those of you today, our CMDA members and champions, who responded to our call earlier this year to make comments on the Department of Education rule and support religious freedom on public universities today. If you'd like more information about the Christian Legal Society, just go to christianlegalsociety.org. There I found some excellent articles and resources that are very helpful, I think, for the times that we live in, including an article entitled "Practical Steps That Religious Institutions Should Consider in the Post-Obergefell World," or another article by Kim Colby on the current legal landscape regarding same-sex marriage, religious liberty protections, and non-discrimination laws. CLS actually has a network of Christian legal aid clinics all across our country, and you can look for one nearest you on their website. We are certainly encouraged by the recent addition of a new Supreme Court judge this past week, who herself is deeply committed to her faith, Amy Coney Barrett from Notre Dame Law School. With that in mind, however, we definitely need stronger legislation to protect First Amendment rights for students gathering at public schools of medicine and dentistry and other healthcare specialties across the country. So support that Senate legislation that Kim mentioned earlier in the interview. Well, if you are as concerned about rising threats to religious freedom as I am, there are two resources that I'd like to mention to you. A great resource is our Freedom to Care website, which Jonathan Embody, our 25-year veteran director of government relations, calls the one-stop shop for religious freedom and healthcare. All kinds of resources are on that site that you will find to help you if you're struggling with conscience protection or religious freedom issue in your practice, or you're just seeking legal help. That website is freedom, the numeral 2, and the word care.org. Also in our bookstore for you is a book entitled Free to Believe, The Battle Over Religious Liberty in America. And that book's by Luke Goodrich from Beckett Law, who was a guest of mine earlier this year on CMDA Matters. This book offers a reasoned, balanced, gospel-centered approach to religious freedom. Goodrich applies biblical understanding to a number of the most hot-button cultural issues of our day. He also offers practical steps Christians can take to respond to religious freedom conflicts in an informed, responsible, and graceful way. You can find this book at cmda.org/store, or just call us toll free at 888-230-2637, and we'll be happy to drop a copy in the mail to you right away. You know, November is upon us, so please don't miss the 2020 Global Missions Health Conference going virtual this year, November 13th and 14th. This actually is the 25th anniversary of GMHC, as it is known, and CMDA truly values our partnership with Southeast Christian Church there in Louisville. We are planning and developing this experience with quality and excellence so that you can connect and learn along with thousands of other people who are interested in healthcare missions. We are very excited this year about the variety of speakers, a wide range of exhibiting organizations, and some special new events. I look forward to seeing you online this November, so please register. Go to cmda.org/events. As I close this program today, I'm reminded of the song with the lyrics, "The more things change, the more they stay the same." King Solomon, more than 3,000 years ago, told us in Ecclesiastes chapter 8, verse 14, "In this life, good people are often treated as though they were wicked, and wicked people are often treated as though they were good." This is so meaningless. As many of us in recent weeks watched the confirmation hearings of Amy Coney Barrett, with so many attacks on her character and beliefs, especially in the sanctity of life as a devout Catholic, that insight from King Solomon was echoing in my mind. Solomon also tells us in Proverbs that righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a disgrace to any people. One of our core values at CMDA is communing in prayer. I think you'll agree that 2020 has been an incredibly challenging and in many ways a rather disturbing year, especially with those of us in healthcare. I invite you, if you're listening, to commune in prayer with those of us in leadership at CMDA. Let's humble ourselves as followers of Christ and pray and turn from our wicked ways and ask God to hear from heaven and to forgive our sin and to heal our land as we go into this month of November with national elections facing us. Living and working in a nation that honors and fears God, well, that's a vision that motivated our nation's founding fathers. I believe that motivation also matters to you as a follower of Christ in healthcare. And of course, what matters to you matters to CMDA, and CMDA matters. Thanks for listening today. We'll see you again next week, Lord willing.
This podcast has been a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on this podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.